Lane was a little alarmed to discover that the man was armed. A single-shot pistol hung at his hip. A further glance at the other attendants in the room revealed that most were armed. Unaccustomed to seeing guns publicly displayed, not even Esau's constable regularly carried one, Senlin took it as a sign that he was entering a more lawful section of the tower. Senlin gave his unpolished attendant a cordial smile. The attendant did not so much guide Senlin as shove him toward an open bathing stall. Despite his anxiety, Senlin enjoyed the hot blast of the shower and the rough, sandalwood-scented soap. It seemed the first bit of genuine luxury the tower had offered him. He would have lingered under the steaming spray longer if his gruff attendant had not roused him. The attendant measured Senlin with a tailor's tape while Senlin stood in his towel, then left and soon returned with a change of clothes, a butler's tails and white starch dickey. Both fit, but neither flattered Senlin's lanky build. He was an unconvincing butler. The red bow tie looked so absurd on him that Senlin immediately removed it. His attendant, however, quickly took up the discarded tie and returned it without gentleness to Senlin's neck.
"No changes to your costume, sir," the steel-haired usher said. "Look to the rules in your program."
Slowly, the full implication of the usher's words dawned on him. He was the actor and the audience. This wasn't theatre. This was a charade. This was a child's game of make-believe. Of course there was no real audience. Who would want to watch? The attendant directed Senlin to pack his clothes and valuables into his satchel, which he did, apprehensively. He loathed the idea of being separated from his money, train tickets and guidebook, but he seemed to have no option in the matter. The fact that the operation was so efficiently run and included so much security gave him some hope. Besides, it seemed he wasn't the only one to keep his money in his shoe, so how safe could it be? His satchel was then locked inside a heavy rolling locker, alongside the personal items of other men, all of whom seemed much more at ease with relinquishing their possessions. And why not? No one sitting in a theatre worried that their coat was being stolen from the coat room. These men had come to escape, to play, to act. They bantered and cackled and carried on like schoolboys, even though much of their hair was grey or gone. Younger men were present too, but they were generally a little fat or awkward or unattractive. It seemed that men who lacked a certain presence were selected by the ushers to play the butler. How fitting, he thought sourly, that he be among them. As he was dressed and primped by his attendant, Senlin read the program he'd been given. The program outlined the plot they'd be embellishing. The play took place in a mansion, so the set spanned multiple rooms and included a dining hall, a study, a kitchen, and a dozen other domestic spaces. There were only four characters in the play: a wealthy husband and wife named Kerrick and Alice Mayfair, a young business apprentice named Oscar Shaw, and Isaac, the butler, his role in the farce. The players were expected to improvise a dialogue around the provided plot. The story was trite enough. The husband, Mr. Mayfair, is consumed with his business affairs. He thinks of his young partner, Mr. Shaw, as the son he never had, and spends much of his time grooming him for the business world. Meanwhile, Mrs. Mayfair, feeling neglected by her husband, has begun to flirt with Mr. Shaw. Mr. Shaw is forced to choose between his future as a businessman and the burgeoning feelings he has for Mrs. Mayfair, a lovely, if not flawed, woman of many moods. Senlin was dismayed to discover that Isaac the butler would eventually have to decide whether to support the mercurial mistress in her indiscretion or to reveal the potential affair to his employer, Mr. Mayfair. It was a nightmare. The plot was exactly the sort of tart melodrama he discouraged his students from reading. The subtext was obvious. Love, pure and eternal, reigned supreme. Senlin did not believe in that sort of love, sudden and selfish and insatiable. Love, as the poet so often painted it, was just bald lust wearing a pompous wig. He believed true love was more like an education. It was deep and subtle, and never complete. The usher grasped Senlin's shoulder with a calloused hand, stirring him from his snit, and escorted him through the far end of the changing chamber into a carpeted hall. The passageway before him was reminiscent of something from a lavish hotel. Whitewashed doors were spaced regularly on either side of the hall, though, unlike any hotel he'd ever visited, this hall had no corners. Rather, it stretched on and on until it gradually curved out of sight. The passage was filled with hundreds of men of varying shapes, but all dressed in the same blacktails and starched bib that Senlin wore. The ubiquity of the red bow tie that itched at his neck made him feel less conspicuous, but only more absurd. It was as if he had stepped between two mirrors and was now watching himself doubled and redoubled into a dimming infinity. The scene made him dizzy. His brusque attendant handed him a key and said,
"Find an unlocked door in the hall. If it's unlocked, the play inside still needs someone to play Isaac the Butler. The other players may already have begun the play. Lock the door behind you. Your key will open all the interior doors that are unmarked and the door you enter by. If you exit to the hall, you cannot re-enter the play. If you exit through another character's door, you'll be removed from the parlour. Do you have any questions?"
A little stunned, but feeling in no position to quiz his handler, who seemed in no mood to answer anyway, Senlin shook his head.
"Enjoy your performance."
"Get through the parlour, get to the baths. She will be there," Senlin told himself again. He felt the familiar cinching of his throat, the throbbing in his fingertips, the telescopic vision that announced the arrival of panic. There were too many people in the constricted corridor. He had to escape. He shouldered his way through the hall of milling, palavering butlers, none of whom seemed in much of a rush to find an open door. This was, after all, their holiday adventure. They experimented with theatrical accents and stage gestures. They blustered over which side they'd support once the play began. "Love must win out. No, marriage is a sacred thing." He wanted to scream. The thought of bursting into some strange room unnerved him, but not so badly as the hall of butlers. He tried a door at random and found it locked. He rattled another. It snubbed him too. The next was no different. The sweat on his palm became a lubricant, and the doorknobs began to slip under his grip. His distress worsened with each rebuff. For a moment, he stood outside himself, watching as this frenzied, willowy fool wrenched doorknob after doorknob. His doppelgangers grumbled and threw their chins at him as he squeezed past. He bumped them against the wainscot and the gold-leaf wallpaper without apology. He couldn't help himself. He was being driven mad, not just by the familiar spasms of anxiety, but by the thought that Maria might be behind any one of these doors, acting in a play where she was one man's wife and another man's lover. He grasped the next doorknob as if he meant to strangle it. It turned. He rushed inside and swiftly locked the door behind him. The silence was wonderful. He stood at the threshold of a kitchen. It was as if he had walked through the back door of someone's house. Split logs lay in a neat pyramid beside a potbelly stove. Nets filled with gourds and onions dangled from exposed square rafters overhead. Jarred preserves glowed brightly in the light of an unshaded oil lamp. The lamp also lit an oddly placed brass nub fixed high on the wall. Senlin was quickly distracted from this oddity by the ham. The ham, pinned with bright cherries, sat on an ornate platter on the servant's table. The aroma of wood smoke, cloves, pork, and seasoned iron warmed the air. It was undeniably delightful and peaceful. He could hardly believe he was still in the Tower of Babel. He stoked the fire and refilled the cast-iron kettle from a sturdy green faucet. It was an automatic act. Water was always on the boil in his cottage back home, ready at a moment's notice for a cup of tea. The pipes gurgled and coughed like an old asthmatic. The domestic chore comforted him. The splatters of grease on the stove made him think of breakfast, griddle cakes, stewed apples and greasy kippers snapping in the pan. He was hungry. No, he was more than hungry. He was ravenous. He abandoned his manners and pulled a thick piece of greasy bark from the bronze ham. Eating the strip in one crude bite, he returned for another, then a third. He chewed and panted and chewed again. He gorged himself, standing over the ham like a vulture, so happy to be alone. The salted meat stung his lips, which were cracked from thirst. He took a teacup from a hook and filled it from the faucet, drinking and moaning with relief. Once he'd scarfed down as much meat as he could stomach, he wrapped a few more pieces in a cloth napkin and slipped the parcel into his pocket. The porcelain teacup in his hands caught his attention, though it took him a moment to realize why. Its lip was painted with a quaint garland of dogwood blossoms. Just a few months earlier, Maria, in the process of melding their homes, had unpacked a straw-filled crate of china, painted with a similar pattern. Her set was a family heirloom, a gift handed down from her grandmother on their wedding day. At the time, Senlin had observed several pieces of her set were missing, and inspired by a desire to please, and also by a preference for completeness, he had offered to locate replacements. Maria had thanked him and tugged at his neck to kiss some softness into his expression. He wondered now, did he always scowl, even when they were alone?
"The gaps are part of the set, too," she'd said. "You can't replace them. I know how each piece was broken or lost. I broke a plate myself when I was 9. Now I'm an immortal part of the pattern. I'll take my gaps, thank you."
She winked and pressed her tongue behind her upper lip. It was a face she had sometimes pulled in the classroom many years earlier, and recalling it made him smile fondly. No, he did not always scowl. Senlin slumped into a chair in the warm sham kitchen and buried his face in his hands. Chapter 9. Inevitably, invariably, eventually you will discover you are unprepared to make an informed choice. When in doubt, say yes. Yes is the eternal passport. Yes is the everlasting coin. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. The obnoxious clanging of a bell woke him. He was surprised to discover he'd fallen asleep. One bell, in a bank of many, mounted over the stove, jerked up and down, pulled by a cord that disappeared into the wall. Reflexively, he leapt toward the door beneath the bells, still clutching the teacup he'd been meditating upon. He entered a long dining hall, which, except for a complete lack of windows, could have been transplanted from a provincial mansion. A parliament's worth of high-backed chairs ran the length of a dining table that gleamed from a recent polish. Brightly painted shields hung in the spaces between tapestries on the wall. Several more of the brass nubbins were set high on the walls. Perhaps they were some sort of air valve? A wide fireplace seethed with enough coals to roast a boar. Though the room was empty, Senlin heard the muffled echo of voices in an adjoining room. Deciding to avoid the other actors in the farce as long as possible, Senlin went to the rack of firewood, selected 2 quartered logs of wood, and angled them carefully upon the grate. He couldn't tell which direction the voices came from. Whoever it was, they sounded passionate, though whether the voices were raised in amusement or anger, he couldn't say. He was still groggy from his nap. He wondered how long he'd slept. Had the play already begun? Had he expected some sort of introduction or preamble? He pulled at the bow tie unconsciously, and wondered if he shouldn't just hole up in the kitchen and wait for the melodrama to run its course. One of the dining hall's many doors flew open, and a woman in a formal hoop gown dashed in with her teeth bared in frustration or disgust, he couldn't tell which. At first, she seemed unaware of Senlin, who stood frozen like a rabbit. When she spotted him, she covered her gritted teeth with an unconvincing smile.
"Isaac, where is our tea?" she asked.
Beyond the open door, 2 men's voices volleyed back and forth intensely.
"Didn't you hear me ring for you?"
It took Senlin a moment to remember he was Isaac.
"Yes,"
he said, feeling a little galled. He was used to being the one who rang the bell to call the children in. He'd not spent 6 years at university only to become some stranger's imaginary manservant. But, wishing to avoid an argument, he forced himself to respond in character, though without a shred of enthusiasm for the part.
"It's not ready."
She closed the space between them, and he saw her cheeks were flushed. Her hair, dark as a wet slate, was styled high on her head. Her complexion was the caramel colour common in the south of Ur. Her charcoal eyes and thick eyebrows were striking, but not in a way that suited the frilliness of her peach-coloured dress. She looked like an over-frosted cake. The effect reminded him of how easily a pleasant work of art could be overwhelmed by a glamorous frame. The neckline of her dress was low and crowded. She took the teacup from him, peered into it, and then turned it upside down, since it was empty. She gave him a disappointed look and foisted the cup back on him.
"Leave the tea for the moment. My husband and Mr. Shaw are arguing in the study. I think it would help to have a calming presence in the room."
Senlin was confused by her theatrics. She seemed physically upset, frightened almost, yet she referred to the other men by their characters' names. Perhaps she was just a talented actress. It occurred to him that not everyone in the parlour was the amateur he was.
"What should I do?"
She flung her hands out in a shooing gesture. It seemed more appropriate for steering a wayward chicken than a man.
"Just go skulk in the study."
She had slipped out of character. Her accent was suddenly rural. Recovering quickly, she concluded with a more staid,
"Please."
Snatching the empty teacup from him, she began using it as a prop, drinking air from it with her pinky finger thrown out. If the act was meant to compose her, or convince him that she was composed, it failed. The cup clattered noisily upon the saucer when she lowered it. He felt sorry for her. She seemed almost as out of place as he was. With a resolute little sigh, Senlin dipped at the waist and said,
"After you, madam."
The chamber seemed more a trophy room than a study. Old bugles, helmets, and sabres hung as decoration on the walls. An unwieldy musket, some 6 feet in length, stretched between pegs over the fireplace. He doubted it was real. An imposing stuffed animal dominated one corner of the room, its long brown fur a little matted with age, but still thick. It took Senlin a moment to identify the beast. It was a giant anteater. The black shock of fur at its throat, its splayed clawed fingers and rivet small eyes, were made more dramatic by its sheer size. Reared on its haunches, it stood nearly 7 feet tall. The heads of deer, elk, and moose were featured on another wall. The low firelight made them appear as if they were leering at him. Two men in dinner jackets argued and paced about a mahogany bar, sometimes stopping to tip the contents of a crystal decanter into their tumblers. Senlin was surprised to recognize the slighter and younger of the two men. It was Mr. Edsel Pining, still with his hands behind his back, bobbing forward as he spoke, like a pecking hen. Pining, obviously cast as Oscar Shaw, the young and romantic apprentice, was having a wonderful time waxing lyrical about the illogic of love and the sterility of business. Apparently, he hadn't delayed initiating the crisis at the heart of the play. He had dived right in. The larger man, playing Mr. Mayfair, was red-faced, grey-bearded, and Senlin thought, alarmingly drunk. Hardly noticed by either man, Senlin moved to the hearth and began shifting the embers with a poker, adding a brighter, more theatrical light to the two men's argument. The woman in the crinoline dress did not stray far from him. She settled her skirts over an ottoman by the fire.
"I took you into my home, exposed my accounts to you, and how do you repay me? By pawing my wife?"
The man playing Mayfair barked and jerked his arm in punctuation, splashing liquor on the fiercely posed anteater.
"I repay your confidence by taking you into my own. I have shown you the ledgers of my heart, and just as a man of business cannot make the price of goods rise or fall as he pleases, a man of the heart cannot dictate how it swings. The stock market of the heart is a fickle thing. Mrs. Mayfair..."
"Is mine! This is not a business, this is theft," he said,
and surprised everyone in the room by dashing his glass on the floor.
"Perhaps we'll continue our conversation when your head has had a chance to clear," Pining said,
hardly containing his delight at the passion of the scene. He turned to the woman whose skirts overwhelmed the footstool and half the rug it sat upon. Pining dipped to kiss her hand.
My dear, I leave you now to sweeten our reunion. Is not the sun most splendid in its exits and entrances? May our setting and rising, our dusks and dawns, be every bit as colourful.
When Pining straightened again, a crystal decanter exploded against the back of his head. The halo of flying glass caught the firelight, causing Pining to appear, Senlin thought, briefly angelic. Pining crumpled to the floor at Mrs. Mayfair's feet, a red spray freckling the front of her peach skirt. She reared back in horror, overturning the ottoman and crashing against Senlin, who stood frozen by the mantel, still holding the poker. Mr. Mayfair, his jaw slack and his chin glinting with spit, stood over Pining.
"She wants me,"
he murmured, dropping the jagged neck of the decanter. Then, more fiercely, he cried,
"She wants me!"
He pointed at the unmoving sprawl of Pining.
"You are a fraud, a little boy fraud. You couldn't satisfy this woman, you foppish, mouthy fraud. She needs a man. She wants me!"
Overcome by drink and fury, Mayfair pulled at his face and careened toward the door Senlin had entered by. Sensing his opportunity, Senlin went to Pining. He had to press his ear to the carpet to see a sliver of Pining's face between the bars of his flowing blood. Through an open eye, Pining focused on him, managing a fragile and unguarded smile. He was alive. The revelation filled Senlin with hope. He was alive. Of course he was. This was only theatre. It was crude theatre, perhaps, but they hadn't stripped off their humanity while pulling on their costumes. The main thing now was to suspend the play and tend to Pining's wound. Senlin had seen many a boy crack his head in the schoolyard, and despite the great streams of blood, none were ever mortally hurt. The floor shook under heavy feet, and the woman screamed. Senlin looked up to find Mayfair charging across the room. He had pulled a sabre from the wall and held it in two hands, like a man carrying a flag onto a battlefield. But there was no flag. No battlefield. There was only a wounded accountant in a costume, splayed on a paisley rug. Mayfair staked Pining between the shoulders with a brutal grunt. Arching, as if he meant to crawl away, Pining showed that the sabre had passed through him and bitten into the floor. He swatted the air twice, then slid back down the length of the blade. Floating on his own blood, Pining drew a breath that rattled like a snore, one that would have woken even the heaviest sleeper. But Pining did not stir. Senlin backed against Mrs. Mayfair, who stood clutching her throat and mouth. Mayfair set his boot on Pining's back and yanked the sabre free. The blade shone darkly with gore. Trembling behind the poker, Senlin felt a tugging at his coattails. The woman was pulling him toward a door set beside the hearth. It wasn't the door he'd come by, and he had no sense of where it led. Senlin resisted the woman's pull, and instead moved nearer Mayfair, who stood heaving like an enraged bull in the middle of the room. Senlin was rattled. Perhaps he was even in shock. But something had to be said. He drew himself up to his full lecturer's height, and spoke in his most scolding tone.
"Are you insane? He was acting! You have killed a man for his dialogue. You are not her husband. You are not Mr. Mayfair."
Senlin pointed vehemently at the ground, a man commanding a dog to heel.
"This is a play, and you have ended it."
Mayfair dug his tongue about the corners of his mouth, as if clearing a bad taste, and then spat on the floor between them. He had the lumbering, apathetic posture of someone who has just risen from a bath. He swung the sword through the air almost languidly. A stripe of blood appeared on the rug. His eyes were red and haunted and dry as coals.
"Get away from my wife, Isaac,"
Mayfair said, and levelled his sword at Senlin. Chapter 10 Anything that distracts from the play becomes the play itself. Everyman's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Senlin wasn't exactly sure when the change had transpired, but at some point in the last dozen years spent as headmaster of Esau's school, he'd begun to think of the entire village as his classroom. It hadn't been out of snobbery, at least he hoped it hadn't. He did not think himself superior to the fishermen or their wives who dried, salted, and crated the cod and tusk. He did not tip his nose at the handful of sooty rail workers who operated their little station, or at the tradesmen who furnished the town with bread, clothes, and ale. Yet he couldn't stop himself from supplying them with little tidbits of knowledge. An explanation of the uniformity of salt crystals, or a note on the evolution of the steam valve gear, or the exotic cousins of domestic yeast. The locals were tolerant of his impromptu lessons, but did not enjoy them. They found such minutiae useless because it made their immediate work no easier. Even so, Senlin persisted, driven by the ideal that knowledge was the great antiseptic. The more educated a society was, the more clean, safe, equal, and prosperous it would be. Of course, the standard of enlightenment by which all else was judged was the Tower of Babel. The tower was, he had been so certain, the great refuge of learning, the very seat of civilization. He preached its gospel, and the villagers rolled their eyes. And perhaps they had been right to roll their eyes. Here he stood, caught in the throat of the tower, preparing for his own violent death. He hadn't a fact left in his head. Mayfair lunged forward. Even in that glimpsing second, Senlin saw no trace of conscience in the man's expression. His rage had purged him of all reason. Instinctively, Senlin flung himself backward through the open doorway, crashing off balance against the loaded book cart. The woman leapt around him as he fell and hurled herself against the heavy door. The latch caught just as the door was battered from the other side.
"Alice, darling, open the door!"
Mayfair shouted.
"My name's Edith, you lunatic, and if you come in here, I'll claw your eyes out," she cried back.
Senlin was relieved that she had finally dropped the act, but he was taken aback by the ferocity in her voice. The door jolted on its hinges.
"It's not locked," she hissed at Senlin. "Key! Where's your key?"
When he took too long to respond, the gears of his mind frozen with shock, Edith began snatching up her petticoat. The voluminous underskirts bunched about her waist. The revealed leg looked like it belonged on a porcelain ballerina tucked inside a musical box. The display did nothing to mitigate Senlin's shock. She pulled a key from the top band of her white stockings, and with her back pressed against the door, tried to fit the key by feel. Before she could seat the key, the knob turned, and Mayfair's arm shot into the room through a widening gap. His hand groped after her furiously, snatching at her hair.
"Do as I say, woman!"
he bellowed. Her heels began to slide. She was losing the battle over the door. She screamed at Senlin for help, and the alarm in her voice was enough to break his petrification. He grabbed the nearest thing at hand, the librarian's cart, racked full of books, and barreled toward the opening door, the cart leading him like a plough. Edith sprang out of the way, and Mayfair cast the door wide just as Senlin launched the cart. The rolling missile struck Mayfair and hurtled him back against the bar. For a moment, Senlin thought he'd knocked the man unconscious, but even as he turned toward Edith, he heard the dashing of glass behind him and an irate animal cry. Again, she threw herself at the door, nearly catching Senlin against the jamb in the process. She set the key and turned the lock. The pounding resumed. The doorknob jerked violently. They listened to Mayfair scraping his own key against the keyhole, but her key, still turned in the lock, kept his from engaging the mechanism. A quick scan of the room revealed they were in the library. Crowded shelves spanned the walls from floorboard to moulding. A round card table and four chairs sat on the medallion of a large rug. A fire smouldered in a fan-shaped hearth. Senlin, in an adrenaline fog, picked up one of the books that had fallen from the cart. He opened it. Sheaf after sheaf of blank paper passed under his thumb. It was a prop. The realization brought his emotions back into relief. He realized he was indignant. No, not indignant. He was angry. He threw the blank into the fireplace. It flared brightly, as if in self-disgust. Why couldn't we be the ones locked in the armory? Edith asked. Her dark hair had fallen from its arrangement and lay in ribbons over her face. They saw the other door in the room at the same moment. It stood open.
We have to block it off, Senlin said.
We'll be trapped, she said. Mayfair's drumming on the door quickened.
I don't want to be backed in a corner. There was a gun in there. You saw it. If it's loaded, we're finished.
Then we must find an exit. Senlin retrieved the fire iron he dropped. He couldn't imagine wielding it, but it comforted him to have it.
You'll have to leave your key in the lock.
Wait a minute, she said,
and then more loudly and toward the door she called,
Don't break your hip, you old cuckold!
Her taunt had the intended effect. Mayfair redoubled his efforts. While he thundered on, they snuck from the room through the unassailed door. There was no time for social niceties or introductions. If they were going to escape the berserk Mayfair, it would be by their wits and vigilance. They would sort out the formalities later, if they survived. For now, all that mattered was getting away. They reviewed their options as they slunk through the house. It couldn't have been helped, but they soon realized they'd made a tactical error by leaving Edith's key behind. If they'd had her key, they might have fled directly to her character's bedroom, where she'd originally entered the play and made their exit. Her chamber was on the opposite end of the stage mansion, and far removed from the trophy room. With only Senlin's key, which unlocked the exit in the kitchen, they'd have to double back through the trophy room or the dining hall that adjoined it. With only two paths, they had a 50-50 chance of running into Mayfair again. To better those odds, Edith suggested that they lead Mayfair as far into the house as possible, back to where the bedrooms were numerous and the halls were tangled. Once they'd drawn him away from the trophy room, they would return to the dining hall and make a break for the kitchen. If they could reach the hall of Isaac's, surely they would find help. Senlin suggested that they lock every door they encountered. Doing so would confuse and slow Mayfair. If every door was locked, there'd be no obvious trail to follow. Edith agreed, and voiced her hope that Mayfair would keep making a racket. As long as he was drumming, they would know where he was. The noise receded a little when they entered a dimly lit conservatory with a harpsichord. Velvet-backed chairs encircled the gleaming instrument. More of the strange brass valves protruded from the walls here. They seemed to be in every room. Hoping to light a candle he'd found, Senlin banked the fire that had dwindled nearly to ashes. But when he applied a lit piece of kindling to the candle, he discovered it had no wick at its center. He threw the wax stake into the fresh logs, bewildered by the ruse. What possible reason could anyone have for pulling the vein out of a candle? It was absurd. He was about to try a second candle when the distant pounding abruptly stopped. They stood alert, a startled deer for a moment, and then hurried wordlessly into the adjacent sunroom. The sunroom was a ghastly mockery. The walls had been painted to resemble windows that framed cauliflower clouds and an egg-yolk sun. A robin, painted in mid-flight, looked more like a smashed bog on a wall than a living bird. Many of the rooms were like this, just clumsy sets. Most of the objects were shells or props. The house was a stage in every way, except that where there should have been an audience, there was only another wall. Senlin found himself wishing for the light of eyes to drive the shadows from the set. For once, he wanted to be the center of attention. They crept onward through chambers and halls. Senlin's heart stopped whenever his key rasped inside a lock. The sound was excruciating, like sand rubbed upon glass. Even their breathing and the rustle of her voluminous skirt seemed to boom. When he came about a corner and was confronted by the raised specter of a saber, Senlin yelped and swatted at it with the fire iron. The empty coat rack bounced against the wall and clattered to the floor. Edith gritted her teeth at him in horror. He gave a helpless, apologetic shrug. What could he do? He was not equipped for this sort of intrigue. He started to explain, but she shushed him and hurried on. After locking the door to a short, drab hallway, they entered a bedroom that was dominated by an enormous four-post bed, canopied with amber-coloured silks. The door to the left of the bed was marked with a polished K.
K for Kerrick Mayfair,
"'We're in his room,' Senlin said, stoking up the coals in the green-tiled fireplace to light the room. Edith began wrestling with her crinoline skirts.
"'This is ridiculous!'
She turned her back towards Senlin.
"'Unfasten me!'
The request startled him. What sort of lady asked such a thing? He gawked at the nape of her neck, her caramel skin, a dark spatter of freckles. He realized that, since the moment they'd been thrown together by grim circumstance, he had avoided considering who she was or how she'd come to be here. Initially, he'd assumed she was a lady because she was playing one, and now he was critiquing her behavior because it wasn't ladylike. It was absurd. He wasn't a butler after all. No, she was a person, like him, with a past and a home. For all he knew, she was lost, or had lost someone too. Perhaps, somewhere at that moment, a man longed for this exact intimate view of her neck. These thoughts surprised him, and revived memories of Maria and the honeymoon he had spoiled. Frustrated by this inconvenient jumble of thoughts, Senlin blurted out,
"'Why? Really? Why do I want to remove 10 pounds of stuffing and frills while being chased by an armed lunatic?'
She watched him over her shoulder, her hand cupping her hair, dark as loam.
"'It took 2 women a half hour to get me into this thing. I can't get out alone.'
He glanced about nervously, and suffered a pang of shame when he saw the bed. She sighed.
"'Are you a monk?'
"'No.
Then undo my dress!'
A slight creak, the briefest complaint of wood beams, interrupted them. The sound seemed to come from the hallway, though really it could have just as easily come from the ceiling or the floor beneath them. In fact, Senlin had the odd impression that the creak had originated from the corner of the room that was farthest from any door and which was empty except for the knob of a brass valve. The hairs stood up on his arms as they did, sometimes, in the classroom, when he had his back to the students. The hairs would rise, and he would know something was amiss behind him. Someone was out of their seat, or an arm was being raised to throw a paper ball, or... He turned twice, all the way around, searching for what had raised his hair. But there was nothing. Just their shadows, writhing upon the wall.
Chapter 11 If the actors are any good, or the script is, or the director, then the audience will be as quiet as a sigh. Unless, of course, the play is a comedy, then quiet is a terrible and tormenting thing. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. When they came upon Edith's bedroom, they found it dark. Senlin retreated to the previous room, lit a length of kindling, and carried it back like a torch. He rushed the sputtering stick to the ash-heaped grate and built up the fire from the wood pail. As he did, Edith tried the sturdy door emblazoned with an A. She didn't seem surprised to find it locked.
Why did I leave my key? It couldn't be helped. I could try to force the door.
Even as he made the offer, he thought back to the door he'd originally entered by. It had been as solid as a dike.
Are you sure?
She said, with a doubtful turn of her head. It was a reasonable assessment, but he still felt the need to defend himself. He was a scholar, not a brute, after all. Perhaps if there were more scholars and fewer brutes in the world, they wouldn't be running for their lives. But he said nothing.
"'Because he'd certainly hear you banging away, and we'd be cornered.'
He couldn't argue otherwise.
"'I know where I am now,' she said. "'The foyer is this way.'
A broad staircase with a green runner ascended to the ceiling, ending abruptly against the flat plaster where a second floor should have begun. The entranceway facing the bottom of the stair was painted on.
"'For all its doors, this house is full of dead ends,' Senlin said. "'The dining hall is through there. We're almost to the kitchen,' she said, picking up her heavy skirts with dramatized effort. "'If he's out there, and I get caught because of these stupid skirts, I'm holding you responsible.'
She gave a fleeting, nervous smile, then glanced anxiously at the poker dangling from Senlin's hand.
"'I wish we had a sword.'
"'I've never picked up a sword in my life,' Senlin said. Seeming disarmed by his candour, she smiled again.
"Me neither."
She saw that the fire iron trembled in his hand, and her smile waned.
"I remember there were things on the walls that looked like shields. Is that right?"
Senlin nodded.
"I say we pull one down, and if it comes to it, we'll use it as a ram. The two of us together should be able to run over one old drunk."
"What if they're fakes?"
"The sword was real enough," she replied.
He wondered why that was. Why have dummy candles and blank books, but sharpened swords? He wished the stern attendant who dressed him had warned him of such things. Better yet, he wished the attendant would dash in with his pistol out and put an end to the whole terrible ordeal.
He unlocked the door to the dining hall with Edith's skirts bunched against him. She craned over his shoulder, peering through the expanding crack. He half expected to see the barrel-chested Mayfair sitting at the head of the dining table, theatrical as a king. But the only life in the room was the fire, snapping inside the deep flagstone hearth. The shields on the wall were enamelled with bright crests. They appeared real enough. Senlin took down a nearby kite shield, faced with a blue cross. It was all he could do to hold the thick iron plate in front of them. He would sooner die than complain about its weight.
"All right. Quietly now," she said, her knees bumping against the backs of his legs.
The hall seemed to telescope before him. The kitchen door receded as they began to move toward it, hunkered low behind the shield. Six doors led off from the dining hall. It was impossible to guess what direction Mayfair might attack from, or he could just as easily be passed out on the floor. Senlin wasn't even certain that all the doors were real. The hair on his arms bristled. Not knowing which way to point their backs, he swung the shield back and forth. They passed the study where Pining had been murdered. The door stood ajar, not enough for them to see into the room, but enough to allow a crack of light to shine into the dining hall. Senlin turned the shield toward the glowing seam, terrified that the light might flicker, fall into shadow, and then explode as Mayfair burst from the room. The image was so vivid that it felt like a premonition. But, of course, he did not believe in such things. The squeak of old hinges interrupted his thoughts. Senlin squinted at the study door and was confused to find that the crack had not grown at all.
"The kitchen!"
Edith screamed, and Senlin spun around.
Mayfair filled the doorway to the kitchen. He seemed as startled as them. A ham hung under one bulky arm. In his free hand, he gripped the musket.
"What is instinct?"
Senlin stood rigid as a totem pole at the fore of the classroom.
"Instinct is an inherited response to a particular circumstance."
His gaze drifted over the rows of tired but attentive children.
"The osprey instinctively knows how to build a nest. The mackerel instinctively swims in a school. Bears hibernate, rabbits dig warrens, and the tree frog sings. They do not know why they do these things, but all of these behaviours benefit the creature and help it to survive."
He strode quickly down an aisle between desks and snatched a folded slip of paper from the fingers of a startled boy. He ripped the note into a palmful of confetti as he returned to the head of the class. The action hardly disturbed his lecture.
"Instinct can be roughly divided into two urges, the urge to survive and the urge to reproduce. In humans, the conscious mind is aware of these urges. We build a society to manage our instincts. In fact, society so thoroughly mitigates our instincts, it is easy to forget that we have them at all."
He turned to the blackboard and began jotting a frenzied list.
"We have customs, manners, governance, the constabulary, traditions, education, fashion, commerce, creative invention, sports, and on and on. All of these expressions of our society work to the same goal of suppressing and managing our instinctual response."
The blackboard rattled and rocked on its feet, shaken by Senlin's emphatic jots. Instinct is the fuel that fires the engine of civilization. Generations have labored to build and perfect the engine. Each of you, I hope, will spend your life working to preserve it, because without it, we would be dangerous beasts. He ran behind the shield. It seemed lighter now. Adrenaline fizzed in his blood as he charged at Mayfair. The brute stood like a steer frozen by the light of an approaching train. He seemed older and more vulnerable than he had before. Senlin saw and absorbed this information, though it made no impression on him. It stirred no shred of mercy. He wasn't thinking. He had transcended all thought. And it felt good. He'd never felt such wild abandon in his life. He sensed Edith rushing along behind him, her own instincts tuned to him as they barreled down the dining hall. They were going to catch Mayfair flat-footed. They were going to survive. Then Mayfair dropped the ham, drew the barrel of the musket level, and fired. He sat at the bottom of a well. There was a point of light far above him. At the bottom of the well, a piercing note rang in his ears. It reminded him vaguely of a finger playing a wine glass. His limbs felt as if they'd been replaced with wet rope. He was confused, but strangely unafraid. Slowly, he began to rise from the bottom of the well, his useless limbs slapping at the sides of the dark. The light grew. He emerged on the floor of the dining hall. He stared at the side of his pale hand that lay by his face. He rolled onto his ribs and felt each one as a distinct band of pain. The shield, dog-eared at one corner, lay nearby. Through the ringing in his ears, he heard moaning and the clatter of wood. Toppled chairs splayed on the floor. Through the bramble of chair legs, he watched retreating boots. Another chair crashed to the floor. It was Mayfair, striding alongside the table, his hip to the edge in a manner Senlin found confusing. The brute kicked chairs from his path as he went, musket still in hand. The sight of the gun fanned the fog from Senlin's mind. He realized that Edith was no longer at his side. He had to get up. Gripping the table edge, he pulled himself upright. He grabbed his head to keep it from exploding. Mayfair's shot had struck the shield and driven it back into the side of his skull. He feared he might black out again. Then he saw her sliding down the burnished tabletop. Mayfair dragged her down the table by her skirts. Mayfair's back was to Senlin when he paused to pour drunkenly at the whalebone ribs of her bodice and the shelf of vulnerable flesh. Edith appeared half-conscious. She groaned and rolled her head, her hair unravelling as Mayfair began dragging her again. Senlin found the poker lying amid the toppled chairs. He raised it high over his head and charged at Mayfair's back, running on the edges of his boots. Edith emerged from semi-consciousness a split second before he arrived and began kicking through the piles of her skirts. Mayfair had time to cock his fist over her, before Senlin brought the poker down, striking him in the muscled notch between neck and shoulder. Mayfair collapsed, bowling through the last chairs as he fell. Senlin lost his grip on the poker, and it flew, clattering end over end across the floor. He didn't try to retrieve it. He tugged at Edith's gown even as she scrambled to the table's edge and onto her feet. She bounced against his chest, her legs still weak from the blow. A ribbon of blood ran down her forehead and over one eye. Senlin saw the gash at her hairline. Though it bled profusely, it didn't seem dangerously deep. They hobbled toward the kitchen door, their four legs crossing and knocking, clumsy as a calf. They managed the two steps down into the kitchen, still aromatic and quaint, though the sham had lost its appeal. The letter I beamed from the door panel before them. Senlin felt the return of his rational mind, and the first thought to emerge from the dark of his instinct was as clear as it was heartbreaking. "Maria will never know if I die. If I die, she'll think I abandon her." They were nearly free. Despite the quaking of his hand, Senlin fit his key into the lock on the first jab. The heavy door swung back, and they tumbled between worlds. A score of black-coated butlers gawked with uncomprehending shock at the hyperventilating couple. Senlin and Edith's appearance was gruesome. Blood painted one side of her face and spattered her hoop skirts. Gory smudges stained Senlin's starched bib. Eyes shining with the clear polish of fear, they loped down the hall together as if they were running a three-legged race, her arm thrown over his shoulder and neck. The butler's initial shock erupted into bedlam. Some men responded in character, bowing as the two of them passed, the gesture inconvenient in the crowded hall. Some berated them for ruining the illusion. Others recoiled in distress, sure that the bloody man and woman were murderers on a spree. Senlin wedged through the black shoulders and split coattails with Edith at his hip. He thought again.
"She'll never know if I die."
A shout cut through the din. The voice came not from the roof of a throat, but from the pit of a stomach. It was the unmistakable trumpeting of rage. Senlin turned and found the centre of the hall cleared. Butlers scrambled at either wall like beetles in a jar. At the end of the parted mob stood Mayfair, with one eye closed behind the bead of the musket.
"She'll think I abandoned her."
A shot thundered. The banks of butlers thrashed and fainted. Chapter 12. Bribery wins more arguments than reason. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Mayfair fell like the house curtain of a theatre. The singed hole in the back of his shirt welled with dark blood. His lungs rattled, empty. A phalanx of white-coated men stood behind him. The attendant at the fore of the troop still held up a flintlock pistol. Smoke curled from the muzzle. Senlin recognized the man behind the gun. It was the attendant who had escorted him through the backstage. The attendant's face was stony. If he had any compunction about shooting a man, he showed no sign of it now. Mayfair had been transformed from a vital, ruddy man into a heap of common refuse. His grey head could have passed for a wrung-out mop. His hands lay flaccid as hot water bottles. His back suggested an overstuffed pillow. Senlin tried not to look at him. At it. If the attendants had arrived a moment later, Senlin would have been the pile of rubbish lying on the floor. Even though it was the second violent death he'd witnessed in as many hours, instead of horror, he felt relief. Great, swelling relief. He was not dead. Arm still hooked around his neck, Edith let out a shuddering sigh that blossomed into laughter. She squeezed him in an awkward sidelong hug. Senlin's posture straightened, his expression tightened. No one would guess that a moment before this same man had been running wildly on instinct alone. Even amid her giddiness, Edith felt the change in his manner and recoiled a little from him. Senlin gave her a thin, appreciative smile. But their relief was short-lived. Soon, it became apparent that he and Edith were going to be detained by the armed attendant and his company. They were grabbed just above their elbows and marched forward, their surprise making them as graceless as marionettes. It was a humiliating parade. After a few dozen paces down the seemingly infinite corridor, they arrived at a door that was only remarkable because it was unlettered. They were bullied through into a hall that was kinked with blind corners. The closing of the unmarked door abruptly killed the cacophony of the hallway. The quiet did not last long. Edith saw to that. She complained about having been locked in with a lunatic and described how narrowly they had escaped. Someone had to be responsible for such a disastrous blunder. She demanded that she be released and jerked her elbows experimentally. It only made her escorts tighten their grip. Despite Edith's increasingly irate protests, the reason for their speedy removal from the halls of the parlour wasn't explained. Indeed, nothing was explained because nothing was said. Their escorts weren't hostile exactly, but the severity of their silence was unnerving. Senlin recalled Gol's warnings about the sort of punishments that were meted out in the parlour. The branding and eye gouging. Still, he couldn't bring himself to believe that such brutality really existed here amid the starched cotton uniforms, brushed carpets, and well-lit corridors. Surely only the criminally deranged were ever tortured. And, he kept reminding himself, they had done nothing wrong. Still, He wished he had his purse. Perhaps the man expected a gratuity for saving their lives. But then, how could he reasonably expect a tip? He'd confiscated Senlin's possessions at the outset. The halls they passed through were only remarkable for the many alcoves and inlets that jutted off from the main passage. Glancing to the ends of these dimmer cubbies, Senlin saw young men and women dressed in the dark navy uniforms of bank clerks. These clerks generally sat on stools, stenography pads open on their laps, pencils ready or scribbling away. All of them pressed an eye to something in the wall. Senlin had to pass several alcoves before he glimpsed the object of their attention. It was a brass eyepiece of the sort one might find on a telescope. The implication was almost immediately clear. The brass nubs in the walls of the stage mansion weren't valves. They were peepholes. It took him a moment more to realize that this was good news. One man's spy is another man's witness. There had to be a witness to the ordeal. Someone witnessed Pining's murder. Someone saw Mayfair fire at them and then drag Edith away with what must have been, Senlin shuddered to think, the vilest of intentions. Their play hadn't been without an audience after all. He and Edith would be vindicated. Realizing this, Senlin caught her eye, even as she continued to deride their escorts, and flared his eyebrows in a way that said, "There's no reason to fight. Don't worry." She squinted at him hotly, but left off with her attacks. The muscular ball of her jaw continued to work restlessly. She hadn't liked his intervention, but he hoped she would be sufficiently consoled when she heard the reason for it. Their procession was longer than either of them was prepared for, exhausted and injured as they were. The blood on Edith's brow and cheek had turned brittle and dark, the wound finally having clotted. Her face reminded him of the waning moon. Senlin's own head throbbed from the concussion of the gunshot. And still they marched through the dog-legging hallways, past hundreds of alcoves, for an hour without any signs of progress or change. Finally, the white plaster corridor opened into a space that could easily have been confused for the foyer of a state capital. Chair rails and ornate black walnut doors, oil paintings and name plaques filled the walls. The air smelled of table wax and leather. Dozens of clerks in navy blazers filed into the vaulted foyer. They hurried between doors like mice between holes. As if in deference to the civility of their new surroundings, their escorts let go of their arms. There were no dummy candles or painted-on birds here, no false doors or empty books. The shams had given away to substance. They seemed to have passed backstage again, but this time they were not in the dressing rooms. These seemed to be the offices of the parlour, or so Senlin supposed. Where else could they be? He would have liked to share this modest revelation with Edith, but she didn't seem ready to want to speak to him. She seemed to have been offended by his earlier signal for quiet and decorum. Perhaps she had thought he was being patronising. Perhaps he had been. It didn't matter. He was already preparing to forget the whole misadventure. He decided that, when he described the events to Maria, he would characterize Edith as headstrong and forward, though, to be fair, she had been better suited to the crisis than him. Cringing, he recalled Edith's request to undo her dress. Perhaps he would avoid recalling the subject to Maria at all. They were finally halted before an elevated desk. An embedded plaque read, "General Receptionist," though the lectern reminded Senlin more of a judge's bench than something a secretary might occupy. He imagined the title of receptionist meant something grander in the vernacular of the parlour. The general receptionist seemed a little harried, overworked even, though he still managed a professional cordiality, which Senlin admired. His desktop was forested with stacks of files, carbon papers, steno pads, and leather-bound ledgers. If there was a system, it was likely his alone. His dark hair suggested that his youth was not so far behind him, but his ears and nose seemed more suited to a man twice his age. Three monocles dangled on jewellery chains from his vest pockets, and he changed them frequently, depending on how far away his subject was. The receptionist dismissed their escorts quickly, located a fresh sheet of foolscap, and said,
Judging by your appearance, I could spend the afternoon apologizing and not finish the job. But instead of delivering the grovelling performance I'm sure you both deserve, let me instead hurry this whole formality along and get you both back on your way.